Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.
So, I've punted Beyond the Rainbow before, back in my very first episode, but I wanted to give a shout out to CJ, because we did a thing. Recently, as those of you who follow my personal Facebook profile will have seen, CJ got in touch and invited me to do some voiceovers for an episode she was working on. Naturally, I jumped at the chance to, as she put it, help a sister out. I took a listen to the episode when it was released, and it's really, really good. And I'm not just saying that because of my guest appearance. Here's an excerpt.
Upon David's arrival back home, Melanie was sitting at the table drinking coffee, and she said to David,
"So, I want to tell you something, but don't get mad. Katie started kissing me, and she kind of moved down to the sweet spot."
Melanie continued to describe in great detail to David what Katie had done to her. And even though David had had other sexual encounters outside of their marriage, David said to Melanie,
"You could have told her to stop. You could have told her no, or turned away."
Melanie didn't say a word. She just sipped her coffee, looking off into space, while a small smile danced across her lips. It would seem Melanie had kissed a girl, and she liked it a lot.
If you haven't subscribed to Beyond the Rainbow, I strongly recommend that you do that now, like right now. Don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. I'll be right here when you get back. All sorted. Excellent. In other news, our merch store went live on TeePublic on Friday night, and I'm super proud of it. Go check it out at the link in the show notes and let us know what you think on the Facebook group. This store is aimed more at our international listeners, but we are working on launching a South African store that doesn't screw you guys in shipping costs. So keep an eye on the group for news on when that local store is launching as well. Lastly, we're now also on Instagram, so if you're on the gram, give us a follow. We would really appreciate the support. Also, links in the show notes. Right, let's crack on.
A Crime Most Queer is an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa, intended for adult audiences and may contain graphic or disturbing content, including detailed descriptions of violence, physical or sexual assault, injuries to victims, and foul language. If you feel this may trigger you at all, please reconsider listening. If you need to talk to someone, please see our show notes for the contact numbers of crisis helplines around South Africa.
Welcome to Crime Most Queer. I'm NJ Hawkerby. Today's case was an absolute nightmare to research and write, and it comes with a serious graphic content warning. A hazard of the job as a true crime podcaster is that we tend to be a bit aloof when it comes to the horrors of the cases we cover, but I struggle to maintain my aloofness with this one. Maybe it has to do with the age of the victim. Maybe it has to do with the circumstances of the crime. Maybe it has to do with the pictures that were pretty much a staple of the press coverage on this story. Maybe it was a combination of all three. I don't know. But I really battled to get going on writing the script. My main reference, and thank fuck for this, was a single article written by author Damien Barr, published in The Guardian, a British newspaper, that he wrote to promote his book, You Will Be Safe Here, which was partially based on this case. I say thank fuck for this because almost every article I opened showed those pictures I mentioned of this broken boy in a hospital bed. So being able to focus on one story and fill in the blanks from the other sources spared me a lot of disquiet. But still, those photos kept popping up on my screen. I eventually just had to copy all of the articles into a Word document and work from that, so I didn't constantly get bombarded by this image, over and over again. I considered trying to secure an interview with Mr. Barr, but I wasn't sure that I would have been able to make it through. This case affected me that badly. So, here's that graphic content warning I mentioned. If you don't cope with stories about kids being tortured and killed, give this one a skip. It's not for you. It's not even for me, but it's a story that needs to be told. Also, Janine already warned you at the start that foul language is to be expected from me, if you hadn't already guessed. But if you are especially sensitive to swearing, just know that your ears are about to bleed. One more thing. If you're staunchly conservative, you'll also want to give this episode a skip. I've never hidden the fact that I'm pretty far left-leaning, politically, and this episode deals with the far right of the political spectrum. I don't pull my punches in my criticism of ultra-conservative political groups that have been a part of the South African political landscape to varying degrees over the years, or the residual bigotry left over from those dark days in our country's history. I may piss off some of you, but it is what it is. You can't say you haven't been warned. And with that out of the way, let's get into it. It was a hot summer's day in Boksburg, just 10 minutes drive from where I am now, the day that her mobile phone rang. Vilna Bays had no idea on that day, March the 23rd, 2011, that when she pressed the green button, her life would change forever. She recognized the number as belonging to Alex de Kocker, the owner of the Echo Wild Game Rangers camp, where her son Raymond was, as far as she knew, undergoing game ranger training, and she thought the call was to give her an update on his progress. The last time she'd seen him was on January the 12th, when he started his training. The last time she heard his voice was 2 months later, on March the 12th, just 11 days earlier. She was right. It was an update on Raymond, but not the update she was expecting. He was in hospital having tests done in the Mediclinic in Vereeniging, an hour's drive away. Alex assured her that she needn't worry, but she's a mother. She and her boyfriend Gijs jumped into their car and raced to the hospital. When she arrived, she was horrified at what she saw, when the nurses eventually allowed her into Raymond's room, that is, but more on that later. Her boy, her beautiful blonde boy, was barely recognizable. He was little more than skin stretched over a skeleton, with more than 60 separate injuries, including a broken arm, broken ribs, and chemical, electrical, and cigarette burns all over his body. The tips of his ears were gone, and his hair had been shorn off. His kidneys were failing, and the doctors told her that he had brain damage. Vilna was told that there was practically no chance of his recovery. He would never regain consciousness. Less than a month later, Raymond Bays was dead. He was just 15 years old. You're welcome to nope out now if you want. What you just heard was heavily sugar-coated. Doesn't get any easier to hear. Raymond Bays was born on June the 2nd, 1995 in Boksburg, about 20 kilometers east of Johannesburg. His father didn't feature much in his life, but Vilna and Raymond got by. According to Vilna, her Ray was a good boy, and while she admitted that she may not have been the best mother in the world, she did the best she could by her son. For the first 9 years of Raymond's life, it was just the two of them. And then Vilna met Gijs Nezaar, and the two hit it off. He was a typical Afrikaans man, a traditionalist. Like most men during the apartheid years, Gijs had been conscripted into the South African military at 18, and he had served 2 years. If you ask any middle-aged South African man, they will almost all say that the army instilled discipline and a sense of duty, something many of them lament is sadly missing in the youth of today. Gijs was a strict man-of-the-house type, and Raymond was a rebellious child. But things seemed to settle down over time, especially with the arrival of Raymond's half-brother, Gijs Jr., or Klein Gijs, as is the norm for referring to Afrikaans children named after a parent or grandparent. Money was tight for the family, but Gijs would buy Raymond boy things, like kit for rugby and cricket. But Raymond wasn't overly interested in that stuff. That didn't stop Gijs from trying to man him up. As Raymond approached his teens, he became, once more, especially difficult. He would often run away from home, and he was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and was even placed on Ritalin, but he refused to take his meds. Just before he went into high school, Raymond was sent for treatment where, in Vilna's own words, quote, doctors attached electrodes to his brain, and it worked for a while, end quote. This surprised me, because it sounded a little like they had subjected Raymond to electroshock therapy for ADHD. But apparently, this is a thing. It's called external trigeminal nerve stimulation, or ETNS, and is used to treat pediatric ADHD in children aged 8 to 12. Now, this treatment was only approved by the American Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, in 2019. But Raymond was sent for treatment in about 2007. So, whether this was the actual treatment he received, or if Raymond was just being subjected to experimental medical procedures in the hopes that something would work, is anybody's guess. But based on Vilna's comments, it didn't stick. And for the record, it still sounds like fucking electroshock therapy to me. Electroshock therapy used on fucking kids. Anyway, Gijs and Vilna struggled to keep Raymond in school, and he would often just not pitch up. Raymond had trouble fitting in and attended at least 3 different schools over the years, where he was often bullied. In one instance, a fellow student pulled a knife on him, and Raymond wet himself. This is something he would do when he was stressed, which just led to more bullying. When it looked like Raymond was about to be expelled from yet another school, Vilna took him out. But Gijs said that he became unruly at home. Gijs, who you will recall had military discipline and Afrikaans traditionalism drilled into him, did not appreciate the disrespect he was being shown by Raymond, taking issue with his smoking, his swearing, and his always being on his phone. Finally, Gijs started looking around for somewhere to send Raymond that would do for Raymond what the army had done for Gijs, and he found one. He heard about a camp that a friend told him had fixed, quote-unquote, his cousin's son. It was a 3-month course, and it was pricey, 22,000 rand, about 36,000 rand, or $2,500 in today's money. But at the end of it, Raymond would get a job. Gijs and Vilna had to take out a loan for that kind of money, but Gijs felt it was worth it. In an interview with Damien Barr, in researching his book, You Will Be Safe Here, Gijs told him, quote, I knew it would be tough, but the army made a man out of me. That's what I wanted for Raymond. End quote. Sadly, expectation versus reality isn't just an internet meme. Alex de Korker, born in 1964, was a true product of apartheid. He served his 2 years of military service in the South African Defence Force, and while there is no record of him ever achieving the rank of general or anywhere near it, he would use this title in later life. He continued to wear his apartheid-era Defence Force uniform long after he left the military, and he had a no-nonsense attitude that exemplified the authoritarian mindset of the apartheid government, an attitude that fell somewhere on the spectrum between cruel and sadistic. In his study in the single-story homestead at the center of a 5-acre farm with no electricity, running water, or toilets, about 50 kilometers south of Johannesburg, where he lived with his wife and several children, the red, white, and black flag of the Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, or the AWB, hung on the wall. Three sevens connected at their base to loosely resemble the Nazi swastika. And photos of him with AWB leader Eugene Terreblanche, both men broadly smiling from the camera, stood proudly on display. The AWB, according to its Wikipedia entry, is, quote, an Afrikaner nationalist, neo-Nazi and white supremacist political party and paramilitary organization active in South Africa, end quote. It was co-founded in 1973 by Terreblanche and dedicated itself to, quote, secessionist Afrikaner nationalism and the creation of an independent Boer Afrikaner Republic in part of South Africa, end quote. During the bilateral negotiations to end apartheid in the early 90s, the organization was known to terrorize and kill black South Africans, and even tried to derail the negotiations themselves by attacking the conference center where the talks were being held. Okay, the AWB's insurgency campaign in the twilight years of the apartheid regime could be an episode all on its own, although it doesn't really fall within the scope of this podcast. But long story short, the attack on the Kempton Park World Trade Center started off kind of like the January 6th attack on the US Capitol. There was a festive atmosphere, more akin to a sit-in or some other kind of peaceful protest. But it devolved into a violent uprising. It escalated to the point where the police were overrun, with one officer who was part of the cordon to hold back the invasion being beaten so badly that he suffered internal bleeding, and an armored vehicle was driven through the large plate glass windows at the front entrance. AWB members streamed into the venue and were effectively left in control of the building, while the negotiation delegates took cover by hiding in meeting rooms. The protesters painted slogans on the walls, pissed on the furniture, and harassed delegates, causing over 700,000 rand in damages, more than 3.3 million rand or $225,000 today. If you're interested, I have linked to the Wikipedia page detailing the storming of the Kempton Park World Trade Center down in the show notes. Basically, a lot of whites in South Africa believed strongly, maybe even feared, that their country was being stolen from them, that the inferior races, quote-unquote, would take over and they would be punished for the apartheid years. They believed this so strongly that they were willing to resort to violence to prevent it. Obviously, they failed to prevent the transition to democracy, and there was no widespread punishment by the previously oppressed races, but that hasn't stopped the spread of the big South African lie. Now, this is a rather unpopular opinion in South Africa, especially for a white South African male to have, and I'm probably going to lose a lot of fans of this podcast because of it, and I'm actually okay with that. But here goes. Many white South Africans often take to social media about a white genocide taking place in the country. They claim that white farmers are under attack, and we have even had politicians say on the floor of parliament that white farmers are attacked and killed at an insane rate, well above our national average, which is already unacceptably high without the need to inflate it. They have even managed to dupe foreign politicians, with the Australian Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton and former US President Donald Trump both getting sucked into their delusion. Although, to be fair, the Australian government did try to walk back Dutton's comments on the matter. Crickets from the Trump White House, though. Those folks who cry white genocide also like to cherry-pick what they consider a farm attack. The farmer was black? Ooh, that doesn't count. The person killed was a farm labourer? No, that doesn't count either. A farm murder is only a farm murder if the victim is white and the owner, or at least relates to him, and the perpetrator is black. White genocide is a myth. Farm attacks definitely do happen, but a genocide? No, that's the part that is bullshit. White genocide is the big South African lie, perpetrated by people stuck in the past, specifically formulated to strike fear into the hearts of a particular group of South Africans who believe that they are being persecuted for the crimes committed by their forefathers. Alex de Korker latched onto that fear. He saw an opportunity to make a fuck ton of money by stoking the flames of racism that is still very much a part of the South African psyche, and turn vulnerable young men into foot soldiers for the imagined coming war. He was training these boys to serve as expendable pawns to protect white-owned farms, and he wasn't scared to bring the full force of his authoritarian leanings down on the boys who were placed in his care. In 2007, at a farm in Swartruggens in the Northwest province, run by Alex, Eric Karlitz, who was either 18 or 25 years old, reports differ, died after he was hit, burned, and wounded. Eric's family were initially told that he died via SMS, claiming that he had suffered a heart attack. The cause of death was later changed to a seizure, and then to dehydration. It was eventually revealed that Eric had died from bleeding on the brain. A few months later, 19-year-old Nicolas van der Walt also died after collapsing while enrolled in the course. He appeared to have been choked with a seatbelt. Speaking to the Star newspaper, Eric's sister, Mathilde Groenewald, said that her brother was slightly brain damaged and struggled to hold down a job despite having had many. She told the paper that he was beaten when he said he wanted to leave the camp, adding that Alex told Eric that he wasn't a morphy, the South African equivalent of the word faggot, and Alex promised to, quote, make a man out of him, end quote. When that case went to trial, Alex was found guilty of Eric's death and received a suspended sentence, but dodged any culpability for Nicolas because his death was ruled to have been as a result of a heart attack. Alex was allowed to continue raising his family and wasn't barred from working with children, despite police concluding that, quote, the paramilitary-style training on this course was not normal ranger training, end quote. That, my dear, is a masterpiece understatement, on a par with calling a tornado a mild breeze, a tsunami a bit of water, and an ice age a bout of nippy air. Let's end this chapter here by quoting Damien Barr in his article in The Guardian. We can never know if Raymond or either of the other dead boys were gay, but they were clearly victims of homophobic violence. Alex didn't make men out of boys. He made corpses. Gijs heard about Echo Wild Game Ranger Camp through a friend, and he and Vilna made the 75-kilometer trip to Mooilande, where the camp was located. Mooilande means beautiful lands in Afrikaans, but it's not that beautiful anymore. Just a collection of agricultural holdings, most of them failing, out in the sticks, 20 kilometers from Vereeniging. The imitation ivory tusks that flanked the gate gave the impression that this truly was what it purported to be, a game ranger training facility. And on either side, stretching away down the length of the property, electric fencing. Not surprising, where the fear of farm murders has taken a vice-like hold of the people living away from the urban centres. As they drove up the driveway, Alex de Korker emerged from the farmhouse. To Gijs and Vilna, Alex, or as he preferred to be called, the General, looked like exactly the no-nonsense sort of person Raymond needed to pull him right. A large man, built, not fat, with handsome features, and it wasn't overly surprising to Gijs to see AWB symbols and memorabilia adorning the walls of Alex's study, in amongst the many, many photos of himself. They also met 18-year-old Michael Erasmus, the General's right-hand man, who had been enrolled at Echo Wild by his parents in 2010 after he had dropped out of school at 13 and run away. He had been on the receiving end of the General's heavy hand several times and had escaped more than once. Each time, his parents returned him to the camp. His last escape attempt saw him living on the street for a month. Eventually, he went back. At least at Echo Wild, he was given food to eat, a roof over his head, and clothes to wear. He didn't have anywhere else to go, and he knew it. His only option was to cave, to give in, to toe the line, and avoid incurring Alex's wrath, Not that he told Chase and Vilna any of this. He wouldn't dare. Not in front of the general. Neither he nor the general made any mention of the two boys who had previously died at Alex's hand. Did Michael even know? It happened 220 kilometers away, 3 years before he was brought to Echo Wild, and it's highly unlikely that the general would have spoken much about it. Maybe he didn't have a clue. That on its own doesn't absolve him of what he would do in the weeks to come. However, this might. Sort of. Indulge me as I digress slightly. When I was about 10 or 11, I found a book in the school library called The Wave, written under the pen name Morton Rue, although it has since been republished under the author's real name, Todd Strasser. At the time, it fucked with my head in ways I couldn't understand. Yeah, that describes it best. I think that's the reason why it stuck in my mind all the way into adulthood. I've never forgotten the title, and I've never forgotten the story it told. It was the novelization of a made-for-TV movie starring Bruce Davidson, which in itself was a fictionalized account of the third-wave teaching experiment started by Ron Jones at Elwood P. Cubberley High School in Palo Alto, California, in 1967. The book is set at the fictional Gordon High School in the spring of 1969 and revolves around a history teacher, Mr. Ben Ross, and an experiment he conducts with his high school history class. He is trying to teach his students what it may have been like living in 1930s Germany, but they had trouble understanding how the German people could have allowed Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party to rise to power, and why they had acted against their own moral compass. Mr. Ross plans an experiment, and the next day he starts indoctrinating the class with the slogan, Strength Through Discipline, ordering them around, making them sit in a specific way, telling them how to answer questions, and so on. The class responds well, embracing the sense of empowerment it gives them. To Mr. Ross's surprise, when he walks into his classroom the next day, the class is orderly and adhering to their newly disciplined behavior. He decides to take the experiment further, creating a group called The Wave, adding two more slogans, Strength Through Community and Strength Through Action, and this leads to more rules of conduct, a symbol, a salute, and an organizational structure, appointing himself as the movement's autocratic leader. Long story short, there's a lot of that in this episode, isn't there? Anyway, long story short, shit gets real. Laurie, the editor of the school newspaper, The Grapevine, who is also a student in Mr. Ross's class, receives a letter addressed to The Grapevine's editor for publication, detailing how members of The Wave are trying to recruit others through bullying. She and her editorial team plan a special issue of the paper devoted exclusively to The Wave, and the negative impact it has had on the school. This doesn't go down too well with members of The Wave, and even her own boyfriend, David, who has been a member of The Wave since the start, tries to get her to back off on the criticism. When the discussion turns into an argument and he shoves her to the ground, David finally sees her point about how dangerous the movement is and realizes that it must be stopped. The couple make their way to Mr. Ross's home, where they try to convince him to end the program before anyone gets hurt. He assures them that he will do exactly that. But the next day, it seems like he is just encouraging the movement when he calls a closed meeting of only WAVE members in the school auditorium. The meeting has all the signs of a Nazi rally, an orderly gathering complete with banners and armbands emblazoned with the WAVE insignia, and Mr. Ross tells them that the WAVE is a countrywide movement with chapters across multiple schools. He says that the leader of the organization wants to address them via television link to announce the creation of a national WAVE party for youths. He then projects an image of Adolf Hitler onto the screen. The students are confused, and Mr. Ross explains that there is no national movement, and there is no leader, but if there was, the man on the screen would be it. Horrified, the kids abandon their banners and armbands and file out of the auditorium, leaving just one boy standing there, in tears, Robert Billings. Robert was the introverted younger brother of a popular Gordon High alum and had generally been considered the creepy class loser before the Wave drew him out of his shell. As he got more involved in the Wave, he became more outgoing and confident. And then he was made a monitor, and the power went to his head. He became one of the most regimented, even dangerous members of the movement. When Mr. Ross brings the Wave to an end, Robert can only watch helplessly and in horror as his entire world implodes. During the Wave's reign, he had finally been accepted as an equal. No one picked on him, and he had friends. He was even his own person, but without the Wave, that is all gone. His newfound social status is worthless now. Without the Wave, he is, once again, nothing. Read the book. Again, it's The Wave by Todd Strasser. It's a short story written for primary school kids, so it's really not a difficult read, but the message is powerful. If you're not into reading, try and get your hands on a copy of the 1981 movie starring Bruce Davidson, or the 2008 German language remake, Die Welle, which takes some liberties with the plot, but gets the story across. Both are brilliant adaptions and worth the watch, and you'll find Amazon links to all three, the book and the two movies, in the show notes. The 2019 German Netflix series titled We Are the Wave is apparently also quite good, but I haven't seen it, and the plot deviates quite significantly from Strasser's book, if the Wikipedia entry is to be believed. But why am I telling you all of this? Remember the AWE flag I mentioned? The three black sevens connected at their bases in a white circle on a red background? The striking similarities to the Nazi party extend far beyond just the AWE's emblem. Indoctrination is key. Rule by fear. Tolerate no dissent. And that is exactly what Alex de Korker did. Brainwashing through violence. Whenever Michael ran away, he would be brought back and beaten. He would flee to the safety of his family, and they would bring him back to his abuser. Is it any wonder that, for his own well-being, he learned to do what he was told? Is it any wonder that he carried out his orders to the letter? I'm not absolving him entirely for what he did. But is it any wonder? Is it? Survival is a strong instinct. People don't want to believe it, but most of us will do pretty much anything to survive. In a you or them scenario, most would choose themselves, no questions asked. While Michael Erasmus showed Raymond around the camp, the three adults sat in the general's study, and he told them about his experience in dealing with wayward boys. He had trained over 300 young men, he said, and at the end of the three-month course, they would be placed in jobs. What kind of jobs? Like safari guides. In hindsight, Gijs figured the jobs were actually more like patrol guards to protect white farmers from falling victim to the perceived white genocide being inflicted upon them, and Gijs was okay with that. He believed the big South African lie. Farmers were being targeted. Farmers were dying and needed support. The general slid a contract across the desk for them to sign. The words "streng vertraulich," highly confidential, screamed at them from the front page. Inside, the contract explained what Raymond could expect. Quote, "We instill faith, discipline, rules and regulations, respect, hard work, hard education, tough physical exercise, bearing, literacy, numeracy, efficiency, reliability, teamwork, animal care and conservation, and community defense." Yes, this is exactly what Raymond needed. Structure, discipline, a firm hand. Echo Wild would do wonders for him. Gijs was sure of it. When Raymond returned, his eyes were themselves full of wonder. Vilna saw a hint of the child she remembered her son to be. He told them that he was going to learn to look after animals, and he would be taught how to scuba dive at Bass Lake, less than an hour from the camp. Vilna signed the contract, arranged to transfer the money into the general's bank account, and it was agreed that they would bring Raymond back in the new year. The family then made their way back to Boksburg. The last photo of Raymond with his mother was taken by Gijs, himself reflected in the window of his pickup, or bucky as we call it in South Africa, on the day he entered Echo Wild, January the 12th, 2011. It was a rather unconventional family photo, but it would have to do. Raymond, tall and stocky, looks unsettled as he towers above his mother. Neither are smiling, but Vilna has her arm linked through that of her son. In the background, a low ranch-type fence runs along the perimeter of the property, and buzzing softly behind it, an 8-foot-high electric fence. Looking at the pictures, I can't quite shake the feeling that the electric fence was there more to keep the enrollees in, rather than any undesirables out. When I first saw the picture, I wondered why it was taken. Was taking photos like this normal for this family? Or did Vilna know, on some level, that everything was about to change? I suspect it was a bit of both. Vilna does seem a little snap-happy. I mean, the photos released to the media of Raymond dying in a hospital bed were provided to them by Vilna herself. And yes, everything was about to change, but not in the way that Vilna would have thought. Her boy was going off to start a new chapter in his life. He was growing up, leaving the nest. The general promised to make men out of boys, and her boy, her beautiful blonde boy, was becoming a man. As Raymond walked through the main gates, between those imitation elephant tusks, Vilna felt a tear roll down her cheek. Chase saw it too, and placed his arm around her shoulders. He assured her that they were doing the right thing, that he trusted the general. Vilna just wanted peace. The last few years had been an emotional rollercoaster. Hopefully this meant that they would soon be able to get off. As Raymond walked through the main gate between those imitation elephant tusks, he felt a tightness in his chest. He loved his mom, and Urges was good to him, he supposed. He didn't want to be here, but he had no choice. So he would try to make the most of it. He would try and make his mother proud. He would stay the course. It was only 3 months after all. He took a deep breath. He could do this. For more. As he approached the farmhouse, he saw the general and Michael standing on the veranda, waiting for him. Neither of them was smiling either. He was led inside, and Michael took Raymond's duffel bag. He was also instructed to hand over any electronic devices, like his mobile phone. He was handed the uniform he was expected to wear, a khaki buttoned shirt, ankle-length khaki slacks, brown shoes, and a green beret, all very reminiscent of the uniform worn by the apartheid-era South African Defence Force. Then he was shown to his tent, and met his roommate, 17-year-old Gerard Oosthuizen. The two boys heads it off almost immediately, and would usually team up when carrying out duties assigned to them, often manual labour like cutting grass with machetes, or stacking stones to build a dam. This is where I need to pause and repeat the graphic content warning. If you're a friend or family member, you don't want to hear this. I'm not going to be holding back in my description of what Raymond had to endure while at Echo Wild. To do so would be a disservice to Raymond's memory. But it's no easier to hear than it was for me to write. Let's go. Days after dropping Raymond off, Vilna called his mobile, but it went unanswered. She tried the camp's landline, but again, no answer. A week later, she drove down to Moilanda, but found the place deserted, and assumed that they were out on field exercises. She went home without seeing or hearing from her son, having no idea what Raymond was going through. Not long afterwards, Raymond made his first attempt to run away. One of the general's neighbors found him and took him back to the camp, and he received one of the many beatings he would endure at the hands of Michael and the general. About 3 weeks into his stay, Raymond tried to take his own life by hanging himself in his tent, but this attempt was thwarted. He tried running away for a second time, but this time he didn't even manage to get off the campgrounds before he was discovered. The general ordered that Raymond be chained to his bed at night. But being chained to a bed was probably the mildest of the punishments he endured. Raymond was expected to ask permission to go to the bathroom, permission that was frequently denied by the general, and as such, Raymond would often soil himself, which the general would ridicule him for, and order that the other rangers do the same. This is another aspect of the training. Bullying was encouraged. If a ranger screwed up, he could expect to get a beating from his fellow recruits. Raymond was forbidden from entering the main house to bath because Alex said he was too filthy. Let's not forget the reason he was filthy was primarily due to Alex. Raymond would have to stand naked in a large bucket of cold water while Michael scrubbed him down using a hard bristled scrubbing brush. The general would often use a shovel to hit Raymond as a form of discipline. Raymond would inevitably end up on his back on the ground as the general beat him, trying to protect himself from the blows with his arms and legs. The reason for using the shovel, according to court testimony, was because it would be difficult to prove what weapon had been used. On one occasion, his being denied use of the toilet resulted in him getting caught short while the recruits were working in a field. He dashed off into the long grass to relieve himself, but when it was discovered, he was forced to eat his own shit. Just over a month after Raymond had started at the camp on Valentine's Day 2011, the general arrived unannounced at Vilna's home. He told her that Raymond was causing trouble at the camp and was refusing to eat. Vilna asked if they could take Raymond out of the program, but Alex responded, "Muni warini, Axel Raymond ven." Now, directly translated from Afrikaans, that says, "Don't worry, I will win Raymond." But a more grammatically correct translation would be, "Don't worry, I will beat Raymond." When translated into English, it's pretty fucking pathetic. Beat him, the general most certainly would. On March the 4th, Vilna received an email from the general. The email contained photos of Raymond wearing a wetsuit. Vilna was surprised at how thin he was looking, but chalked it up to the training he was receiving. It wasn't. In the next photo attached to the email, she could plainly see that Raymond was emaciated. She called the general and demanded to know what was going on. He told her that Raymond was self-harming. She insisted that she speak to her son. The general was, at first, reluctant, but when Vilna threatened to get the police involved, arrangements were made for a phone call on March the 12th. The general also asked for Vilna's medical aid details, just in case Raymond hurt himself badly enough that he needed medical attention. March the 12th finally arrived, and for only the third time since leaving Raymond at the gate of the camp, Vilna got to hear her son's voice. As before, the call was placed on speakerphone, with the general keeping a watchful eye and an attentive ear on Raymond and what was being said during the conversation. Vilna asked Raymond why the general had told her that he was hurting himself. Raymond denied this outright. "Ma, I'm not doing it to myself." The call was instantly cut off. The general hung up. This would be the last time she heard her son's voice. Vilna would later tell Damien Barr that she believed that Alex knew that there was a good chance she would never see her boy again. He took their money, knowing that he was going to kill her son. It's hard to argue with that. The abuse that Raymond suffered at the hands of the general and Michael Erasmus while at the camp was cruel to the point of sadistic. I had every intention of describing what Raymond went through in story form, but it got a bit much for me. He was 15 fucking years old, and the abuse he endured, that was an almost daily occurrence. Like, what the actual fuck? Anyway, let me just run through the list, as reported in the media. Raymond was often too weak to carry out the tasks assigned to him, and would be beaten with planks, sticks, and rubber tubing as punishment when he failed to discharge his duties to the general's or Michael's liking. Punishment for transgressions could also range from being tortured with boiling water to being dragged behind a moving bucky. There was also the incident where the general physically slammed Raymond's head into a wall for some unknown reason. Michael said that he couldn't remember what Raymond had done to deserve it. The fact that the details surrounding such a brutal act were easily forgotten seems to suggest that this was not an uncommon occurrence. Raymond wasn't only forced to eat his own shit. On another occasion, after he knocked over a container of washing powder, he was forced to eat what he had spilt until he started vomiting foam. Not even unconsciousness spared him from the brutality. If Raymond passed out during one of the many, many assaults, he would be kicked and slapped until he came to, and the abuse would continue. And then there's the incident in the chalet. Stick around. I'll get to that one in a bit. According to witnesses, Raymond would frequently complain of pain and constantly held his left arm against his chest. When Raymond was admitted to hospital, he did indeed show signs of a broken arm and broken ribs, which were up to a month old, which the examining physician claimed were the worst he'd ever seen. Again, this kid was 15 years old. 15 years old, and he was put through hell. It's a miracle that he survived so long. Actually, no. It's a fucking travesty that he survived so long. When Vilna got the call on March the 23rd, 2011, with the news that her son was in hospital undergoing tests and that she shouldn't worry, naturally she raced to his side. Initially, the nursing staff wouldn't allow her in to see her son. According to the man who had brought the boy in, he'd been abused by his mother. When she finally got through to them that she hadn't done this, that she'd been 50 kilometers away, that her son had been enrolled in a training camp since mid-January, the hospital social worker called the police, and officers raided Echo Wild Game Rangers Camp. Michael Erasmus was taken into custody, but Alex de Cocker, the general, was nowhere to be found. He would go on the run for a week before finally turning himself in. Meanwhile, at Mediklinik Vereeniging, Raymond's prognosis was dire. For more than a month, Vilna watched her son grow weaker and weaker, gradually wasting away. She prayed for a miracle that her son, her Ray, her beautiful blonde boy, would wake up. The medical staff tried to explain to her that Raymond's injuries were severe, the worst some of them had ever seen, that the odds of him recovering were virtually zero. But she didn't want to hear it. She clung to her faith, begging and pleading with her God that Raymond be returned to her. On April the 20th, 2011, 10 years ago today, Raymond finally succumbed to the injuries inflicted on him while at Echo Wild Game Rangers Camp. In the wake of Raymond's death, Michael and the general had murder added to the charges of child abuse and assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm that they were already facing. They both pleaded not guilty to all charges. As harrowing as the photos that made the papers were, nothing could have prepared the world for what would eventually come out during the trial. Michael tried to paint himself as just another one of the general's victims, a man who lived in fear of Alex's wrath, and to a certain extent he was. He had not gone to the camp willingly. He had repeatedly been assaulted by Alex. He had run away from the camp several times, but each time he turned up at his parents' door, hoping that they would be fucking parents and keep him safe from the monster, they just handed him back to the monster. His final attempt to escape the general's clutches saw him living on the street. He couldn't go home. His parents would just take him back to the general. Eventually, after a month of being cold, hungry, and alone, unable to pull himself out of the hole he was in, he realized that his only option was to go back and face whatever punishment was coming his way for his absconsion. At least there, at Echo Wild, he had some sort of semblance of life. That was the moment where he realized that he had nowhere else to go. And in that moment, Alex won. Michael's spirit had finally been broken, and now he was nothing more than a diligent little minion. He did as he was told, without question or deviation. Orders were orders, and were to be followed to the letter. One way to survive the monster is to become the monster. Remember the wave. Remember how easy it was for sane, sorted, sensible young people to get swept up in a sense of unity, a sense of camaraderie, the seductive nature of belonging. It happened a lot during World War II. It happened in the classroom experiment in 1967. It happened in Washington, D.C. on January the 6th this year. It definitely happens, but not everybody gets swept up. For some people, herd behavior, or more accurately, herd mentality, presents an opportunity to explore their dark side. Deep down, they are cruel and sadistic, and when they encounter a man like Adolf Hitler, or Donald Trump, or Alex de Korker, someone who actively encourages them to be the worst that they can be, they embrace it. Witness testimony suggests that Michael Erasmus was just such a person, the yin to the general's yang. The Heinrich Himmler to his Hitler, the Josh Hawley to his Trump, the poster child for Stockholm Syndrome, if the Svegas 4 were all sadistic fucks. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Following his arrest, Alex published a statement on Stormfront, a neo-Nazi internet forum with, according to Wikipedia, the dubious honor of being the web's first major racial hate site. He claimed that he offered, quote, crucial services to protect the farmers' community, end quote, and that Raymond had been, quote, cast away due to his rebellious nature by his mother and her boyfriend when they dropped him off at the gate. They were willing to pay thousands of rand just to be rid of him. The young man's behavioral deviations were noticed immediately, end quote. Alex never elaborated on the nature of these deviations. The trial of Alex de Korker and Michael Caspar Erasmus began in the Vereeniging District Court on April the 22nd, 2013, with the two men appearing before Magistrate Rita Willemse. Right from the start, Alex went out of his way to gum up the works and delay the trial, from repeatedly changing lawyers to marrying his second wife in the courtroom. And throughout the trial, he constantly tried to pass the blame. He claimed that he never touched Raymond, insisting that the boy was mentally ill and had inflicted his injuries on himself. According to Alex, Raymond had burned himself with boiling water, cut himself with wire, and refused to eat. On the last claim, the prosecutor would later ask during Michael's cross-examination if Raymond was ever denied food. Michael responded that he wasn't sure, but remembered a day when Alex had instructed him to take Raymond's food away because Raymond ate too slowly. Alex denied that Michael was simply carrying out the orders he had handed down. According to Alex, he was never at the camp. Well, hardly ever at the camp. Okay, he was away 60% of the time, at least, and he always left Michael in charge. But Michael was a bully anyway, so he should be held responsible for what Raymond endured. During cross-examination, Michael confirmed to prosecutor Kurbis Jacobs that this was what Alex had told him to say, that Alex was never at the camp. In return for taking the fall for Raymond's abuse, Alex promised Michael a car, money, and a new position on a different farm. Well, seeing as I'm telling you about it and I'm working on what was reported in the press, I guess little Mikey realized that a car, cash, and creature comforts and a cushy job were unlikely to materialize when you're both facing 20 to 25 years behind bars. Instead, Michael testified that Alex was home most of the time, only leaving the camp to fetch and carry his children. On the topic of, someone else who eventually turned on Alex was his eldest son, Antoni. But I guess when your own father tries to pin a murder on you, there's not going to be much love lost there. Initially, Antoni had offered the bullshit story that his father cooked up. But when Alex tried to finger Antoni, who would occasionally help out at the camp, for Raymond's death, Antoni changed his testimony and aided the state in the prosecution of his father. Neither Antoni, nor his mother, nor his sisters faced any charges for what went on at the camp. As far as I can tell, they weren't even subjects in the investigation. Witnesses did not lay the blame entirely at Alex de Korker's feet, however. While Michael insisted that he only ever carried out Alex's orders and only ever in the presence of Alex and never used anything more than a stick to hit Raymond because, quote, it was unnecessary, end quote, other boys of the camp, like Gerard Oosthuizen, claimed otherwise. Michael testified that the abuse he had inflicted on Raymond was carried out at the direct order of the general, and that he didn't dare question or disobey those direct orders, or he could, and almost certainly would, find himself on the receiving end of similar abuse. According to Michael, when Raymond first arrived at Ekker Wild, he was windgat, an Afrikaans word defined by some online dictionaries as braggart, But my understanding of the word is that it means something more along the lines of cocky, arrogant bullshitter. Either way, he had an attitude problem and refused to take orders. This did not sit well with Alex, who had a violent streak, and in Michael's own words, quote, "If you don't think like Alex, you get hit. You become like a robot," end quote. Alex had previously grabbed Michael by the throat and struck him for not doing the task assigned to him correctly. He would frequently beat his own children with a broomstick, and Michael had witnessed Alex throw a glass at one of his own daughters. Michael was instructed by Alex that if Raymond didn't come right, they had to dawner him right. Basically, Alex made it quite clear that they needed to beat the shit out of Raymond until he was on the, quote, right path, end quote. Alex had very little compassion for the children in his charge. When Michael mentioned to Alex that he had noticed Raymond was losing weight after a few months at the camp, Alex brushed off his concerns, saying that, quote, "it was probably AIDS or another type of sickness," end quote. For me, this is plenty of evidence, in my opinion, that Alex believed that Raymond was a fag and needed to be beaten back onto the straight and narrow. Tell me again how this isn't gay conversion therapy. How it's just a survivalist camp or a training program for right-wing militia. During cross-examination, Prosecutor Jacobs asked if Michael had noticed that Raymond was in pain. Michael said that he had. When asked if he had reported this to Alex, and perhaps recommended that they get Raymond medical attention, Michael said that he had not, for fear of also being attacked by Alex. Michael's defense revolved entirely around the fact that he did what he did to protect himself from Alex's temper. Basically, Michael was in self-preservation mode, and, as we have already established, self-preservation can be a pretty fucking strong driving force in how one behaves or reacts to a situation. But Gerard testified that Michael was a willing participant. He said that he had personally witnessed Michael inflict grievous bodily harm on Raymond of his own accord, using a variety of implements to do so. His fists, his feet, sticks, planks, rubber tubing, a sickle. Yeah, Gerard testified that Michael had used a fucking sickle as a weapon. It had been Michael who had ordered that Raymond eat his own shit. It had been Michael who forced Raymond to eat the spilled laundry detergent. He had been the one to beat Raymond with whatever was close at hand, often when the general was not around to bark orders. And then there was the incident in the chalet. When Raymond's second attempt to run away was thwarted, Alex had him tied to a flagpole sometime between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. According to Michael, Raymond looked very weak, and Alex told Michael to remain at the camp that evening, as he would need help dealing with Raymond. At about 7 p.m, Alex told Michael to get a chair, chains, a bucket, a pillowcase, and a taser, and to make sure that he wasn't seen, that nobody knew what they were doing. Michael then went and untied Raymond from the flagpole and took him to the chalet, where he was stripped naked and tied to the chair with his hands behind his back, and the pillowcase was placed over his head. Alex instructed Michael to throw a bucket of water over Raymond, and Alex proceeded to shock Raymond with the taser, punch him, drench him with more water, and kick him in the balls. According to Michael, this went on for quite some time. Despite Alex having instructed that nobody should know what they were up to, unbeknownst to them, they were observed. Gerard saw what they were doing to Raymond. He heard Raymond's screams, and his blood ran cold. Knowing that he couldn't help his friend, knowing that if he were discovered, he would be next, knowing that he was no match for Alex and Michael, he fled back to his tent in fear and pretended to be asleep. When Michael brought Raymond back to the tent, he chained him to the bed, and Raymond was chained to the bed every night from then on to prevent him running away or committing suicide. Michael would later claim that this was done on Alex's orders, but Gerard had his doubts. Gerard didn't get the impression that Michael was acting under duress. On Raymond's last night at Echo Wild, Michael was in his own tent, which he shared with his girlfriend, Cindy Nell, and Raymond was in the tent he shared with Gerard. According to Michael, Gerard said that Raymond had walked backwards, fallen, and then had a convulsive seizure. Gerard screamed, and Michael came running. When he entered the tent, Raymond was unconscious on the floor, and Michael tried to wake him by hitting him in the face. Yeah, those are the words that they used in the press coverage of the trial. I would have gone with slapped him across the face, but I actually wouldn't put it past either of these two fuckers to have tried to revive Raymond by punching the kid in the head. Michael told Gerrit to get the general, but Alex said that Raymond was faking it. Eventually, Michael was able to convince Alex that they needed to get Raymond to a hospital in Vereeniging. Michael recalled how he'd seen Vilna at the hospital and apologized to her before returning to the camp. Vilna never mentioned this encounter, but I think she had more important things on her mind just then. On Friday, February the 27th, 2015, almost 4 years after Raymond took his final breath, Alex de Cocker and Michael Erasmus were led into the dock in the Vereeniging District Court to hear their fate. Outside, activists from the organization Women and Men Against Child Abuse had created posters which they attached to the fence surrounding the court. One read, "Life Sentence for Child Killers," while another read, "Hou hulle in die tronk," which means, keep them in jail. Propped up against the fence near the signs were two small white handmade coffins, each with a photo of Raymond and the letters RIP. Meanwhile, inside the courtroom, family of both the victim and the perpetrators filled the public gallery. Near the back, a middle-aged man had a newborn baby girl in his arms. The man was Casper Erasmus, Michael's father, and the child was Michael's daughter, born just 5 days earlier. If her father were to be found guilty, she would likely not see him outside of weekly prison visits until she was well on her way to adulthood. In her judgment, Magistrate Rita Willemse didn't hold back on her criticism of the two accused. Starting with Alex, she called him a pathetic witness, saying that it was absurd of him to try and claim that he was unaware of Raymond's injuries. In her view, Alex tried to mislead the court and that he hadn't wanted Raymond to return to his mother because he was benefiting financially from having him in his clutches. Turning her attention to Michael, Magistrate Willemse rejected his claims that he was just following orders and that he didn't have a choice, finding instead that he was a willing participant in the abuse. Not only did he not just follow orders in his abuse of Raymond, he also did it out of his own initiative. Also, the fact that Alex provided accommodation for both Michael and his girlfriend, and that a bank account had been opened for him, was motivation for Michael to continue what he was doing. Then the magistrate detailed the abuse that Raymond endured at the hands of the two men. The punching, the assault with shovels, sticks, rubber piping, being forced to eat soap powder and his own shit, being kicked and slapped while unconscious to wake him up. She went over the witness testimonies where they stated that during his time at the camp, Raymond was dirty, neglected, and would soil himself, and how he had difficulty walking properly and would often collapse. She spoke of their assertions that Alex would justify the physical abuse he inflicted on Raymond by claiming that he was lazy, had a bad attitude, and would pick at his wounds. And the toll it took on Raymond's state of mind, causing him to, allegedly, try and commit suicide, which just brought on further abuse in that he was then chained to his bed. She discussed the injuries that Raymond suffered. He was emaciated, dehydrated, and experiencing convulsive seizures. He had a broken arm and a fractured skull. His body was covered in chemical, electrical, and cigarette burns, and a plethora of bruises. He showed signs of brain damage and kidney failure. And mercifully, he was in a deep coma by the time he was taken to the hospital. The examining physician stated that there were also signs of old, untreated injuries, some up to a month old, and they were the worst he had ever seen. As the magistrate read her judgment, Michael sat hunched forward in the dock, his chin resting on his hands, while Alex sat next to him, staring straight ahead, his face expressionless, as the evidence was summed up. Eventually, Magistrate Villancer pronounced her verdict. Alex de Cocker, accused one, and Michael Erasmus, accused two, were found guilty of all charges. Murder, child abuse, and assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm. Sentencing was set for April the 17th, 2015. When the two convicted murderers returned to court 7 weeks later, Magistrate Willemser made it clear that the crimes for which the men had been found guilty were among the worst. She had said that Alex had shown no remorse during the trial, and despite Raven being no more than a defenseless child, he was tortured and left with no less than 61 injuries on his body. The assaults were, in her opinion, premeditated, and the torture systematic. She called out Alex's refusal to accept responsibility, saying, quote, "You were the person in charge. You were the only person on that plot that could have put an end to the tragic incidents, but you didn't." End quote. She also noted that the assault, torture, and murder of Raymond Bays was not Alex's first trip around the block, as his previous conviction was also assault involving children. Quote, "This court has the duty to give you and other offenders a very clear message that crime against children will not be tolerated." End quote. 49-year-old Alex de Cocker was then sentenced to 20 years in jail for the murder of Raymond Bays. He was also sentenced to 5 years for child abuse and 2 years for assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm, the latter two sentences to be served concurrently. Turning to 22-year-old Michael Erasmus, she said that he was a suitable candidate for correctional supervision because he showed potential for being rehabilitated. Quote, "At the time, you were on the emotional and intellectual level of a child." End quote. Michael was sentenced to 3 years correctional supervision with a 12-year suspended prison sentence should he reoffend in that time. The magistrate warned him that while correctional supervision may seem like a light sentence, it was not, and he would need to explain to his newborn child one day what he did to a teenaged boy that resulted in men in uniforms coming to visit her father regularly. Naturally, Alex de Cocker, never one to accept responsibility for his actions, indicated that he intended to appeal his conviction and sentencing, because of course he would. Raymond would be 26 years old this year. Instead, today marks 10 years since he died. But in that time, what's really changed? Alex rots in a jail cell and Michael does not. Michael's correctional supervision ended 2 years ago and he's been able to move on with his life. Something Raymond can't do. But what about Vilna? In the weeks and months following Raymond's death, as details were coming to light as to what had happened, Vilna became a target on social media of people who believed she knowingly sent her son off to gay conversion therapy, and as such, she was to blame for what happened to him. It got so bad that she actually had to move. I don't believe she did send her son off knowingly, and I don't believe she is responsible for what happened to him. I believe that both she and Chase were sucked in by a manipulative bastard who played on the emotions of an entire culture for his own financial gain. But I don't believe she would have knowingly sent her son off to die just because he may have been queer. That said, a quick gander at her social media profile tells me all I need to know about her gullibility. Despite losing her son over the big South African lie, she still buys into the white genocide myth. I guess some conditioning, some brainwashing, is hard to undo. Vilna and Gijs had planned on getting married. It was going to be a surprise for Raymond when he had completed his ranger training. He was going to give Vilna away, but instead of a wedding, they had a funeral. Gijs and Vilna are no longer together, but they are still a part of each other's lives through their shared custody of Klein Gijs. Vilna doesn't blame Gijs for what Raymond went through, simply saying, "None of us knew." But let's get back to my question. 10 years on from Raymond's death, what's changed? Well, nothing that would ensure something like this won't happen again. No legislation has been passed to outlaw conversion therapy. When the question is raised as to what kind of protections are to be put in place, the same answer is given. But our constitution prohibits discrimination. Well, fat lot of fucking good that did Raymond Bayes now, didn't it? Racists and bigots are resourceful motherfuckers. They will find a loophole to anything that stands in the way of them spreading their poison and hate. So we've got to plug those holes. We've got to ensure that the next Alex de Korker finds the world intolerant of his intolerance. And to do that, we need laws or precedents in place that say, that shit don't fly here. At current, we have neither. In fact, if you take a good, hard look at this country, there are a lot of holes that need to be plugged when it comes to queer rights and protections in South Africa. Let's start with preventing those who commit heinous crimes against our community from ever seeing the outside of a prison. Go sign the petition. There's a link in the show notes. Thank you for coming along on what was, for me, the roughest case I've covered so far, hands down. And thank you for your patience. I want to give a shout out to David Normanton, Anna Zeitz, and Sharon Partington for helping me keep the story straight and encouraging me to get the fuck on with it. I couldn't have gotten through this without you. Lastly, go and check out the merch store. You'll find a link to that in the show notes. I'd love to hear your feedback. To be honest, I have no idea which case I'll be covering next time. This case was so difficult that I haven't even thought that far ahead. If you have a suggestion, get in touch on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, and let me know which case you think deserves the label of a crime most queer.
You've been listening to A Crime Most Queer, an LGBTQ true crime podcast based in Johannesburg, South Africa, presented by VA Amazing and written and produced by NJ Hawkeby and Janine McLean, with editorial oversight by Richard Thompson, original music by Joseph McDade, and additional voice talent by Janine McLean and others. See our show notes for more info. A Crime Most Queer is available on most podcasting platforms, including Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and others. Remember to subscribe on your podcast app of choice to be notified when we release new episodes. And if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, be sure to give us a rating and leave us a review. We really do appreciate hearing from you. If you would like to support the show, you can become a patron from just $1 per month by going to patreon.com/ACMQ podcast. Or make a one-off donation at paypal.me/ACMQ pod. We post all episodes along with additional content to our website, www.acmq.co.za. You can find us on social media by searching for A Crime Most Queer on Facebook and Twitter. We also welcome your thoughts, either on social media, or you can email us at comment@acmq.co.za. While this story is based on actual events, some situations, conversations, and characterizations may have been fictionalized or invented for purposes of dramatization, based on court documents and press reports from the time. With respect to such fictionalizations, any familiarity to actual character or history of any person, living or dead, is purely for dramatic purposes. Some names may have been changed to protect the identity of those involved.